You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
At the UPS Store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS Store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
As you start watching what's unfolding, whatever the problem is, it's a leadership problem. Like that's number one. There's a problem. The problem is a leadership problem. Oh, yeah. Something that Leif always brings up is that there's two measures of leadership. It's either effective or it's ineffective. So if it's been working for 17 years and it's not working now, that means it was effective before, but it's ineffective now. And we have to get over our ego, figure out what the real problem is, and solve it.
The fact that you have to realize on the battlefield or in a business that you're doing something wrong as a leader, you have to almost sense in your body, oh, I have a little too much ego going into this situation, and that's why I just missed something because there was an ego blind spot. And I sort of feel a lot of these dichotomies you talk about in the book, a lot of it is about noticing first, there's a little ego I'm putting into a situation, and then figuring out exactly what's happening.
Ego causes so many problems, and that's one of the things we talk about. If we see problems on teams, if we see friction points and some failings or things that aren't happening the way they should, I mean, 99.9% of the time, there's some ego issue in there, and someone's not able to check their ego, putting themselves before the mission, before the team. That's one of those things you got to balance. You have to have an ego, because if you don't have ego, you're not ever going to strive to do anything. You're not going to compete. You're not going to try to be the best in what you do. And yet, ego can also be totally destructive. And we see leaders that'll just, they'll ride a plan into the ground and destroy their entire company just to prove that they were right, because they can't admit their plan was a failure.
And I think you see that a lot more in corporate America than in the battlefield.
You might be surprised by that, James. We saw troops put themselves in serious harm's way, and it cost people their lives, or at least caused people to be seriously wounded and injured because they didn't listen to some very valid criticism. It was all a matter of ego.
So I am so happy once again to have Jocko Willink and his frequent co-author, Leif Babin. Did I say the last name right?
Got it right, James. Good work.
So welcome back to the show. Jocko, it's your third time on the show. Leif, your first time. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So we want to identify for the audience who is who. So Jocko.
This is Jocko, and this is About How I Talk.
And Leif.
This is Leif. This is How I Talk.
Now, you both actually sound like Navy SEALs. Like, does the voice, like, get deeper in Bud's training? Like, did you always talk like this? Like, if I want to talk like I'm a Navy SEAL, I'll lower my voice. And...
That actually didn't help, James.
Clearly, I'm not a Navy SEAL.
You do have to raise your voice during combat situations or training situations. You have to yell. And again, I don't want to give the impression that people... that in the SEAL teams, we just yell at each other or yell to give direction to people. But when there's gunfire going on, in order to communicate, you actually do have to yell. And since we do iterative training where we're doing that type of yelling over gunfire, your voice can take a little bit of abuse, and sometimes it has an effect to make it a little bit more raspy.
Ah, because you've been in, like just how many combat situations would you say between the two of you you've been in?
A lot. We got a lot. I mean,
is a lot like 12 or is it 1,000?
Not 1,000. I mean, there's a lot more people have done a lot more than us. But we were very fortunate in our deployment together to Ramadi in 2006 to be part of some really intense urban urban combat operations, and we got in what we did 150 plus combat missions for our task unit.
Well, and this is going to be related, of course, to the book. So first off, before I say the title of the book, Jocko, I owe you a huge apology.
It's okay.
You were total. I said to you in the last podcast, oh, just as a throwaway comment, oh, that's a bad title for your book. So the book's called The Dichotomy of Leadership. And not only is it a great book, it's a great title because for every important, like you always see these books, like here are the 12 rules of leadership, but there's always a flip side. There's always the other side where for, you know, rules are made to be broken. And I think that's that dichotomy is understanding at a core level, oh, I'm hitting that area, that fuzzy area where I may need to consider this core rule of leadership. And so that's the dichotomy. And you give 12 examples of where that dichotomy could take place. And this book is structured very well. You both wrote it. You go back and forth. You kind of list, a chapter title might be, you know, what one of the rules of leadership plus its you know, opposite.
That's for instance, disciplined but not rigid.
Right, disciplined but not rigid. And then you'll give the military example of where you might be too disciplined, but then, and so you have to learn to be not rigid in certain situations. Then you explore the principle, and then you give the corporate example because now you two guys run a company, Echelon Front, where you take your principles of leadership and apply it to corporate situations. And so, and it's very interesting to see how the exact concepts you learn in these life and death situations kind of resonate in the corporate level. And as I'm reading the book, I've been involved in many types of businesses. I run a business. I can see all of these things. I'm thinking of myself, oh, I should be doing more of this, or I should be thinking like this in this situation, or here's where I made a mistake and didn't quite follow the dichotomy. You know, sometimes I stick too rigidly to what my core values are. And you see this, I'll get into questions in a second, but you see this constantly when you're describing the battle situations. This is real life and death, you know, situations, and you're learning the hard way, the hardest way possible, where your standard operating procedures might need to be kind of in flux a little bit, you know, moment by moment. Like,
absolutely. And just like you said, where you may notice as a leader, you're sticking too rigid to something and you need to be more flexible, that absolutely happens on the battlefield. And that's something that once we were running training, we tried to make the leaders aware of the fact that sometimes your standard operating procedure is not going to work and you have to be able to be creative and come up with another idea to solve the problem.
You know, but it seems like with the Army and with the SEALs, your standard, and I don't know anything about it, so correct me if I'm wrong, but your standard operating procedures are so drilled into you, it must be hard in a battlefield situation to say, I have to change, you know, or I have to make different sense of this than the 99 out of 100 times where the standard operating procedure works.
Well, we actually train to a point that people learn to recognize that their standard operating procedure isn't going to work. And one of the ways that you do that is as a leader, you don't get totally absorbed in the tactical situation at hand. You actually detach, you step back, you remove yourself from that immediate problem so that you can look around and see what's actually happening and recognize that there's got to be a better way to do this because what we're doing right now is not working. And as far as, you know, I talk a lot about Jimmy Page because Jimmy Page, you know, probably if not the greatest, definitely one of the greatest rock and roll guitarists of all times, but he began his career as a studio musician who had to play the notes specifically as they were required and as they were written. And because he was so disciplined in that practice, eventually when he formed Led Zeppelin and was allowed to let loose, he could see that he was free to create massively and impromptu on the spot, create these incredible riffs because he had that discipline and that structure up front that allowed him more freedom on the backside to be creative. And that's the exact same thing that happens on the battlefield with a good combat leader.
And, you know, I think it happens in basically every area of life. So for one thing, the Jimmy Page example is great. Has Led Zeppelin even made one bad album?
No.
I think they're like the only band in history that's not made a single bad album.
I put the number for a band to be great, you've got to put 5 good albums out in a row. And there's not a lot of bands that can do that. You know, you got Led Zeppelin, you got Black Sabbath, you got AC/DC and Motorhead.
That's funny. I don't know.
Anyone else?
I'm not as familiar with Motorhead.
5 is a lot. That's a lot of albums.
5 is a lot.
I would put Metallica in there, but Jocko doesn't, anything after the Black album in Jocko's mind is not real Metallica.
I still like Led Zeppelin the best.
Absolutely. But Black Sabbath's better, but it's okay.
But you know, it also reminds me of like something Kurt Vonnegut said, which is, you know, he's often considered experimental, but he said you can't be experimental unless you know the rules of grammar first. Like, you got to be a good writer before you go be experimental. Andy Warhol was probably the best illustrator for all the advertising agencies on Madison Avenue before he, you know, created pop art. Like, before he was able to, he knew enough about just standard traditional art, and he had the skill and the talent before he could, and he developed his craft before he could go and riff. And I think that happens in every area of life. But of course, again, in a battlefield situation or a business leadership situation, there's often very high stakes, not just career stakes, but, you know, lives are at stake, or jobs are at stake, or businesses are at stake. And so it's interesting, again, to see how you guys, like, and there's a certain Zen quality to it as well. The fact that you have to realize on the battlefield or in a business that something's going wrong, that you're doing something wrong as a leader, you have to sort of see, almost sense in your body, like, oh, I have a little too much ego going into this situation, and that's why I just missed something because there was an ego blind spot. And I sort of feel a lot of these, the dichotomies you talk about in the book, a lot of it is about noticing first there's a little ego I'm putting into a situation, and then figuring out exactly what's happening.
Ego causes so many problems. And that's one of the things we talk about. If we see problems on teams, if we see friction points and some failings or things that aren't happening the way they should, I mean, 99.9% of the time, there's some ego issue in there. And someone's not able to check their ego, putting themselves before the mission, before the team. So that's one of those things you got to balance. I mean, you have to have an ego, because if you don't have ego, you're not ever going to strive to do anything. You're not going to compete. You're not going to try to be the best in what you do. And yet ego can also be totally destructive. So when you put that, you know, I've got to be right before actually the mission comes first, and I don't care who gets the credit for it, that becomes totally destructive. And we see leaders that'll just, they'll ride a plan into the ground and destroy their entire team and company just to prove that they were right, or to at least not to admit that their plan, because they can't admit their plan was a failure.
And I think you see that a lot more in corporate America than in the battlefield, I bet, because, again, it's higher stakes in the battlefield because there are lives at risk.
You might be surprised by that, James. We saw, there's an example in here in this book. There are multiple examples we give you from the battlefield where troops would not listen to some obvious, very helpful constructive criticism from people that were there on the ground, and put themselves and their troops in serious harm's way, and it cost people their lives, or at least cost people to be seriously wounded and injured because they didn't listen to some very valid criticism, or, hey, you should think about this or that, and they thought they knew better, and it was all a matter of ego.
Well, and you give a lot of examples in the book. I like the example, Leif, I think you wrote this one, and you guys alternate writing different chapters. There was the one where you're moving forward, and I think Chris Kyle was on the team, and he suggested a different building for you to look east instead of south. And I think it was you who you were the commanding officer in that unit. I don't know if I'm using the right.
Ground force commander is what we call it. So I'm the senior guy on the ground. And Jocko actually came in, rode in the back of a Bradley fighting vehicle, which is kind of a smaller tank. And they were moving down this, it was probably what, 3/4 mile from the main route through the city down this road where they're trying to get in. It took, what, like 3 or 4 hours for them to get there because they were clearing out IEDs the entire way behind the mine clearance helmet. But I had to lean on Chris on that. I was the senior guy in charge. I'm the leader. And, you know, as we say that in that chapter, you have, in order to be a good leader, you also have to be a good follower as well.
Right, that's the dichotomy in that
chapter.
And you were questioning yourself, though, like, There was first you had to wrestle with the ego before making the decision. Like you had to decide, is this a situation where I lead because I am the commanding officer here? Or is this, you had to sense in yourself, no, I think better to follow. Like, so how do you recognize that in yourself when you're hitting that gray area where the dichotomy, where this yes or no point in leadership starts, you start to feel it in yourself?
That detachment that Jocko talked about, that's all important. And if you can take a step back and think, okay, what's best for the team? What's best to accomplish the mission? And in that situation, I mean, here's Chris Kyle. He's my most experienced sniper, not only in our platoon, but in the entire task unit, and one of the most experienced snipers in the SEAL teams at that point. And even though he's, you know, I outrank him, and he's a junior leader on the team, I've got to listen to him. He's got more experience than me. So I need to listen to him and I follow his plan that he's recommending, because ultimately it's not about me, it's about the mission. And I think that's where ego comes into play. Leaders want to prove, no, this has to come from me. It has to be my idea so that I can show everyone that I'm in charge. And ultimately, if you try to do that, people just lose respect for you. And the thing that people are scared of, like, will they lose respect for me if it's not my plan, is actually the opposite happens. People gain respect for those leaders because you can see that leader cares about the mission more than himself. It's not about him. He puts his ego in check. And those are the kind of leaders that people admire and want to work for because they're successful.
Right. And then there's the example where your other soldiers had the patches sewn on, you know, they had kind of semi-frivolous patches sewn onto their uniforms, and you didn't want to annoy the other units they were working with. But then they kind of disobeyed you a little bit by sewing it on the inside of their uniforms.
You're saying they, like it was someone else. It wasn't someone else. It was my guys. In fact, it was this guy sitting next to me. And to kind of set the stage a little bit, there was the U.S. Army and the Marine Corps are very strict with their uniform policies. And it's deeper than that. They're just strict with their uniform policies. They actually judge other people on if they can wear their uniform correctly. And that's not an insensible thing, because if you think about it, if you're in the Army and I'm in the Army and I look at your uniform and you can't wear your uniform to the standards, you can't wear your uniform correctly, then how can I actually trust you to do anything correctly out on the battlefield? So I knew that the Marine Corps and the Army looked at uniforms that way. Now the SEAL teams, we don't think that way. And in fact, we don't really care what uniform you wear or what you look like. And so in the SEAL teams, we have a tendency for guys to wear mismatched uniforms. They'll wear their civilian hunting pants and a pair of hiking boots and a workout t-shirt underneath some brand new, hot off the press, tactical top. And so they look like a bunch of gypsies going into combat. And I knew that we would get judged by that. So I said, listen, guys, we're going to wear the proper uniform. We're going to wear...
You knew you were going to get judged because this was a situation where you're going to be working with other units.
Yes. When we went to Ramadi, I knew that we were going to be working very closely with the Army and the Marine Corps. And so before going, I said, look, we're going to wear squared away uniforms, no mixing, matching, and squared away haircuts, no big beards and goatees, which SEALs love to grow and think it's cool. And that's fine, but in this situation, it wasn't appropriate. And so I said, look, wear good uniforms. Now, once we're wearing good uniforms, the guys start thinking about, well, how can we make our fashion statement, right, if we can't wear uniforms? And the way you can do it is by wearing little patches. And the patches would start, you know, everyone wears an American flag. But then, you know, let's not just get an American flag. Let's get a, you know, football team flag on the other arm. And then let's get some quote from some movie that we like, or let's
more
get some,
cowbell was one of my favorite ones.
Yeah, we'll get one that says more cowbell from Saturday Night Live, and you know, just the most random things. And then it starts to get to, let's say you can make the most completely inappropriate patch, something that's just completely offensive to everyone, and we'll wear that because that'll be funny. And so as this started to get more out of hand, I went to Leif and the other platoon commander, Seth Stone, and said, all right, guys, hey, we're not wearing patches because, again, we want to make a good impression. We want to build a good relationship. We want them to think that we're good to go. And so we're just going to look uniform and no patches. And these guys, you know, they said, hey, sounds good to us. We won't wear patches. And this was pretty much right before we went on deployment that I laid down that law. And that's the way it went. Or so I thought. Because Leif had other plans. Go ahead.
So what Jocko didn't know was that we... me and Seth Stone, so the two platoon commanders. So we're the next. I'm the second senior guy in Task Unit Bruiser, and then Seth is the third senior guy in Task Unit Bruiser. So we're his direct reports. And we had said, you know what, we need a patch. So we designed these patches. I had one that was Lord Humongous from the Road Warrior, and then we had another one that was a big cow skull. And that's it.
Wait, is Lord Humongous the one with the red hair who's like always screaming?
No, Lord Humongous has the metal hockey mask on.
Oh yeah, yeah. When I was a kid, that guy scared the hell out of me. That was the scariest movie.
That's weird. I identified with him on a personal level.
So
in the dystopian world that we're entering into, you guys are going to win, and I'm the first one dying. I don't escape from New York, so I don't even have to worry about that world.
So we put these patches together. We secretly had them made. I mean, we had to get somebody to sew them real quickly. We boxed them up. I shoved them on one of the pallets. We fly to Ramadi. When we land in Ramadi, I like snuck them off the pallet. But under, you know, when Jocko and his immediate staff were away, we like distributed amongst everybody, and then we'd have them hidden in our. There's a cargo pocket that you have on your shoulder of your uniforms, and there's Velcro on the outside of that. So if Jocko,
this is a lot of work to disobey Jocko.
It was a whole lot of work, and we know there's a lot
of stakes, which is important to note.
If you disobeyed Jocko, so as we're rolling out on operations. We'd have those patches in the pocket. So if Jocko was staying back in the tactical operations center to monitor if there are multiple operations going on, then he'd stay back on base at the TOC and our tactical operations center. So we'd be rolling out, and the call would come over the radio, patches on. So everybody would take their patches, slap them on their uniforms, and now we had our patches. And what we didn't plan for, because we're not used to these sort of things, like we go out in operations as just SEALs. But we were working very closely with the Army and Marine Corps, and one of the Army units had an embedded reporter with them, and they took a bunch of photos, and these photos come back to Jocko, and sure enough, there's a big patch on the arm.
Yeah, they come back for clearance to make sure that I think they're appropriate to be sent out without revealing any classified information. So I'm scanning through the pictures, and it's completely just staring right back at me that the guys are all wearing these patches. And of course, this was... in complete disobeying of what I had told them. And on top of that, you know, this is early in the deployment. This is a matter of weeks into deployment where we are absolutely trying to establish a good reputation with the Army and Marine Corps. So it's unbelievable that these guys would make this huge effort to disobey something that I told them when it made perfect sense to listen to what I was saying so that we could provide better support and get more respect and do more combat operations with the Army and Marine Corps. So as I sat there and looked at these patches, you know, the first minute that I sat there, I was, you know, going through my mind the various punishments that I was going to unleash.
As soon as I found out about it, I knew, right, the hammer's going to fall. And this is me. I mean, I did it, so I'm expecting the absolute hammer to fall.
What's a possible punishment?
Well, there's all kinds of things. I mean, everything from keeping them, you know, the worst punishment that I could have done to either him or the other platoon commander would say, you're not going on missions, and make them stay back. And we did that to a couple guys through deployment, and that's the biggest punishment you can give a SEAL is say, you're not allowed to go on operations. So that was my first thought. I was like, okay, these guys don't want to listen to what I'm saying. Fine. He's not going out on any operations. And then it went, you know, there's all kinds of things that went through my mind for about 30 seconds to a minute. And then of course I sat there and thought about it. And part of the thing that was making me want to punish them was my ego thinking, how could these guys ever disobey? And believe me, these guys did more, you know, did everything I ever asked them to do. And here they are disobeying me. That hurts my ego. So I should just crush them, prove that I'm the guy that's in charge. That didn't last long. And then I said to myself, okay, why would they actually be doing this? Why could this be so important to them that they actually, these guys that have done everything I've ever asked them to do, that they've taken this thing to make a stand on, it means a lot more to them than I realize. And I looked at the patches. They were smart. They made the patches tactically sound. They were just the same color as our desert uniform. They didn't stand out. They all matched so everyone looked uniform. And I knew if it meant a lot to the platoon commanders, then it must mean a lot to the platoons as well. So instead of unleashing punishment on them, I didn't do anything.
Right, so you didn't even mention it to them that you knew, right? Did he mention it to you?
Well, I knew that he knew, but I was waiting for the hammer to fall, but it never did. And he never came and said, hey, keep you're cleared hot. You can wear all the patches you want. But I, so we knew we still kept it. We didn't rub it in Jocko's face. We never wore the patches around him. We always kept it hidden, and we'd say our patches on as we rolled out. But I knew that he had decided to not drop the hammer, and it was a big lesson for me, because you look at Jocko, he's this big, intimidating, scary guy that people think he's going to hold the line in every situation, and I think it was a great example of this dichotomy. You know, there's some things that where you got to hold the line, there's some standards that have to be held and you can't compromise, and then there's some areas where you need to let that go and you need to let the team actually have some room to run. And you don't want to smash everyone down all the time, and it was a big lesson for me, and
right,
it was a real example of the dichotomy.
Right. So there's this dichotomy on leadership that, you know, in general you want to keep good discipline, and I think that is that it, which specific dichotomy was that? Is that the discipline but not too over discipline?
That was specifically the chapter of hold them accountable but don't hold their hands.
Right. So what first ran through your head was kind of anger. And the anger comes from maybe two parts. One is there's the ego of I'm the commanding officer, I know best, so they should have listened to me. And there's also the ego of, are they insulting me? Mm-hmm. Like, did they just do this in my face? Did they not like me? Like, there's both things happening, perhaps.
For sure. And I felt a little bit of all that. And again, I mean, at this point, I was 34-year-old man. I mean, I wasn't like I was all freaked out. In my heart, I just knew that these guys, they're young, they've got their platoons, they're proud of their platoons, they're proud of this task unit, and they want to show that pride to the world. And that's not a negative thing. That's
right.
Actually a positive thing.
Right. So you had that initial, like you said, 30 to 60 seconds of anger/ego, but then you asked the question, why are they doing this? And then you asked the question, Has anything changed for us tactically? Like, are they putting us at risk tactically, or is there at risk with the original reasons of my order, my initial order? Like, you know, if it all sort of looks the same, it might not, you know, be so much in the face of the Army and Marine units. If it matches the uniform, so it's not going to give away their positions or whatever. So you ran through a couple of questions for yourself. You realize it must have been important if they had to go. Like, he just described, took him 3 minutes to describe all the things he did, including sewing the patches or whatever under the pockets to avoid you finding out. So you realize it must have been super important for them to have this happen. But still, how did you get over the insult? Like, it's not like you're 100% cohesive with your own guys.
Because it's just about overcoming your ego. And you know, it's actually at this, even at that point in my life, it was like, hey, these guys are more important than me. You know, these guys are more important than me. And if it means a lot to them, then I'm going to deal with it. And that's okay. The other thing that you got to think about is how much leadership capital do I have? How much leadership capital do I have? Right now, we're 3 weeks into this deployment. We got 6 months of deployments ahead of us, 6 months in this deployment ahead of us. And for the next 6 months, I'm going to be asking these guys, my brothers, to go out, risk their lives on a daily basis, to take this massive amount of pressure, to be in situations that they could get wounded or killed on a daily basis. I'm asking them to do that. I'm asking them to be professional. I'm asking them to get virtually no sleep. I'm asking them to eat a bunch of crappy food. I'm asking them to be away from their families and their wives and their loved ones. I'm asking them to do all this stuff. And on top of all that really meaningful stuff, I'm gonna nitpick because they want to put a cool patch on their uniform. It's leadership capital. And I'm not going to waste it on things that don't matter.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a three-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a three-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast, and the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails, like, hey, you're qualified for this or that, and so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
At the UPS store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
I think understanding the concept of leadership capital is extremely important because anybody only has so much. You can't, if you went in And you bring up these examples throughout the book, so many different examples. If you go in and you micromanage every day, you quickly spend all your leadership capital. If you go in and you start yelling at somebody every day, you quickly lose all your leadership capital. And there's ways to gain leadership capital as well. When you do like what you did with Chris Kyle, you gain leadership capital, particularly when the mission's a success. But in this case, one question is, did you feel they knew that you knew now that they were disobeying? So did you feel like you should at least acknowledge to them, hey, I see what you guys did. This is why I think it's okay. Because do they start thinking, hey, we got away with something a little bit. This is like the Giuliani's broken window thing in New York City. Like if there's one broken window, there's going to be a lot of broken windows. So does Leif start, do you wonder if Leif starts to think, hey, I just got away with something small. Maybe I'll get away with something a little bigger.
And that's why we wrote about the dichotomy in the book of these radios that the guys needed to know how to program. And so to make a long story short, we all carry a radio in the field. And the radios that we use them in a certain mode that only talks to the other SEALs. And when we got to Ramadi, we needed to learn to use it in the mode where it can talk to the Army and talk to the Marine Corps. Now, in a SEAL platoon, there's a radio man. And the radio man is like when you have an IT guy at a company, you just give the IT guy your computer and he fixes it, and then you get it back and it works. And that's what a radio man does. If there's something wrong with your radio, you give it to the radio man, he fixes it, gives it back to you, and it works. The problem in Ramadi was we were split up into smaller groups, and I knew that sometimes in these smaller groups, these guys wouldn't have a radio man with them. And if they got separated from the radio man and they needed to talk to the Army or the Marine Corps, they would need to know how to utilize these radios in that mode. And so I said, listen, everyone in this task unit needs to learn how to program these radios themselves. I put that word out. A couple days go by, and it's one of the early missions where after I'd put this word out, and you know, we got done with the brief. Leif's platoon was going out, so he briefs his platoon. And when he would get done briefing the platoon with his guys, I would, you know, stand up and say, hey guys, here's a couple things to think about. Make sure we move fast to the target. Make sure you maintain security and make sure you hit the checkpoints with the Marines on your way in so that they know where you're at. Everyone got that. You know, I just kind of cover some major points, and I kind of got covering whatever my major points were that day. And I said, does everyone know how to program their radios? And I got no yeses. And no nos. I just got a bunch of nervous looks. And I could tell that they didn't. And I said to one of the new guys in the front row, I said, let me see your radio. And he very nervously pulled his radio out of his gear and handed it to me. And there's a button on the radio that you can hit, and it erases all the information in the radio. So I hit that button, I gave it back to him, and I said, okay, now program your radio. And he didn't know how to do it. And I realized right there that, okay, I said, listen, until you guys know how to program your radios, you're not allowed to leave the wire. You're not going to go on any missions. And that's it. The guys said, okay, stop. We're going to go learn how to program these radios. And everyone learned how to program the radios. And they knew that I was going to absolutely hold the line on that. And there wasn't going to be any slack given whatsoever. Again, that's because this is a matter of guys' lives. If you're stranded out there in the middle of Ramadi and you need to talk to the Army and the Marine Corps and you don't know how to program your radio, that could cost you your life. Wearing a patch will not cost you your life.
Right. So it's still the same two-step thing. Like you have that 30 to 60 seconds, like, why didn't these guys listen to me? Why didn't they obey their commander? And then you could ask why, and it could have been they were busy or they're just lazy or they didn't realize the importance. And one thing you stress repeatedly in the dichotomy of leadership is that if you're going to enforce this leadership capital, you have to explain why that they're doing it and why it's important. And you were able to do that. And then you also, there's consequences of not obeying. Then you kind of outline the consequences because there's a strong why they need to obey you.
That's right. And let me ask you this. If they didn't program their radios, whose fault is that?
Then it's yours. Extreme ownership.
It's absolutely my fault. It means that I didn't explain to them, in a manner that they truly understood how important it was that they know how to program their radios. I didn't do a good job of it. And so how could I be mad at them because I did a bad job explaining to them how important it was? The answer is I can't.
And from my perspective, watching that happen, I mean, it was what most leaders are going to do in that situation is they're going to yell and scream or get angry or demonstrate, you blew me off. I told you to do this and no one did it, and blame everyone else. But Jocko didn't do that, and I think it was so much more effective. Because if you do that, then people just get defensive. Then no one really sees the value in it, and you probably still get some people that resist.
And you lose that leadership capital.
You definitely would lose some leadership capital, and you'd have less people that actually program the radios, which is the whole goal. The way Jocko reacted to that, it wasn't mad. You know, it was kind of like, I'm not angry, I'm just disappointed thing. But it was, hey, I'm not backing down. I understand. He knew we weren't blowing him off. I mean, we respected Jocko's leadership immensely, and I didn't think it was unimportant, but with the 50 other things we had going on, it just kept getting bumped down the priority list. So he realized that, hey, you guys were just getting pulled in other directions. You didn't fully understand and realize how important this is. Now I'm showing you how important it is. Make sure everyone does this now. And so it was a great example of what to do, because we didn't lose respect for Jocko. We didn't see him get angry, get emotional about it. But we just realized, wow, this is important. We should have done this. We didn't make time for it. And now we will. And after that, not only did everybody in Charlie Platoon know how to program the radios, everybody in Delta Platoon, the other platoon, and everybody else knew as well, because we passed the word to everybody. Hey, you better know that, because Jocko's going to call you out and zero somebody's radio. You better be ready for it. So it worked.
Did you ever see Jocko get angry where he, you know, the ego took over in any of these situations?
No, actually, no. I have not. I have seen Jocko get angry, but it wasn't a matter of ego. I think it was a calculated response for a particular situation. And, you know, of all the times that we worked together for 13 years now, and particularly in those early years when he was the task unit commander and I was his platoon commander, I'm sure I gave him hundreds of opportunities to want to yell and scream or, you know, get angry with me. And he never did that. Zero times.
In the movies, you always picture, you know, Army people or SEAL people or whatever arguing and screaming at each other, you know, give me 1,000 push-ups, you know, and that doesn't happen.
Only the worst leaders do that.
Yeah, only bad leaders will do that. And the situation that Leif was talking about was a situation where I clearly, in my normal tone, hadn't been effective in getting it through someone's thick skull that what they were doing was inappropriate and they shouldn't have done it. And so I said to myself, okay, I need to escalate my emotional situation, my emotional behavior, so that they realize that I'm very serious about this. So, you know, I raised my voice, made some pointed comments, and then walked away.
What was the situation? What did they...
A situation that shouldn't have happened.
That's all I'm going to get out of you on that one, right?
That's all you're going to get out of me on that one.
But still, there was the... I hate to keep saying this, but still, but I like the fact that there's this emotional control component of the dichotomy of leadership, which is something happens that is, you're following your standard core values of leadership. Something happens goes awry, and the first reaction of any boss, leader, whatever, is going to be this anger or ego component, but then you have to ask why. If the why is in favor of the person who's on the opposite side of you, then you have to, or if the why is not good, you have to explain why something's important to you and then what the consequences are if they don't follow you. So I'm trying to kind of work through this so that it's easy to kind of take into everyday life, into my life, and understand when these things occur in my own life. So I'm gonna be angry sometimes at people, but I have to see, is it more important to them? Does it affect me? Does it affect their life? How do I build leadership capital? How do I explain to them? Maybe I need to escalate my voice a little bit. Maybe I need to kind of use logic to explain to them. Maybe I need to have good consequences if they don't obey me, even after I explain to them. So there's kind of a formula to getting from one side of the dichotomy to the other.
There is, and what you just said about getting angry, and you asked earlier, you know, how do you know when your ego is starting to get out of control? When you're getting angry, that's a really good indicator that you need to step back and assess what's actually happening and see if it is your ego. And then once you clear, hey, it's not my ego, if you did something, if you made a mistake and I'm really mad about it and I clear and it's definitely not my ego, then why am I mad? Well, I'm mad because James might hurt himself. Okay, Now I need to make sure that I articulate to you what I'm concerned about, what could possibly go wrong, because I want to make sure you understand you could hurt yourself if you make this mistake again. I'm not mad at you. I'm mad at myself that I didn't explain it well enough, but I care about you. You're my teammate. I don't want anything to happen to you. I don't want you to get hurt. I need you to do this so that you don't get hurt. And that's where we come at it from. We don't come at it from barking orders.
Right. So it reminds me, like, I often think of anger as fear clothed. So let's say in this situation with the patches, instead of viewing it as anger, viewing it as fear clothed, you think, oh, am I losing? I'm afraid I'm losing control of my unit. I'm afraid, are they flaunting this in my face? Am I afraid I'm not authoritative enough? Am I afraid the Army and Marines might not like us or work with us as well? But when you get through that fear and see from their point of view, okay, it's not so bad. I don't need to expend leadership capital on this. I'm not even going to mention it. You know, you're able to avoid losing that leadership capital by just like barking out orders. And so I think of it. Do you have kids, Leif?
I do.
So how many kids? And I know you, of course, have kids. You have we've talked about the Way of the Warrior kid.
I have four kids. Yeah.
So four
Warrior kids.
It reminds me when I'm dealing with my kids. When they were young. And even now, I would never yell at them because thinking about it abstractly, a little girl doesn't need to be yelled at by a big man. Like, I don't want her to grow up thinking that's how the men in her life should treat her. But when she did something or does something that, or one of my daughters does something that is against what I think is best for her, I'll usually say a word you just used a little while ago, which is, hey, I'm disappointed you did this. It's against what I said. Here's why this might be bad for you. And then she'll just do whatever she wants, but at least I said my thing, because it's harder to have consequences. I mean, I don't know how do you punish your kids?
It depends on what they did wrong. It depends on what the transgression was, because there's certain transgressions that cross a line that is not supposed to be crossed at all. And so if you cross that line, there's going to be significant punishment behind it. And that can be anything. That can be anything. I'm a big fan of yard work. And I'm talking about meaningless and hard and painful yard work that takes entire weekends to complete. When I tell my kids to put their work clothes on, they're immediately repentant on their actions. So yard work's a good one.
That's a good consequence.
Yeah. And I don't even have that big of a yard, but I got some weeds. I got some rocks that need to be cleaned. You ever cleaned rocks before?
No.
Yeah, you don't want none of that.
I live in this city, so I don't even have I can't get them working on anything.
Maybe I'd have a clean sidewalk out in front of my apartment if I lived in the city.
Right.
Real clean.
Yeah, that'd be good. I'm going to have to remember that. They're 19 and 16 now. They might not listen to me.
Trash pickup in Central Park.
Yeah. I've done trash in the house, but trash pickup in Central Park might be good.
So, I think as long as there's consequences, right? There has to be some things where, you know, just to the same thing we were just talking about for the SEAL platoons. There's got to be some things where people are going to be held accountable when they cross the line, and there's also going to be some things that you got to let go. And particularly, my kids are habitual line pushers. They're little, you know, they're
young. Supposed to be line pushers because that's how they learn where the line is.
And
they don't know.
They will run all over you. Obviously, you know, if you let them do that. So, but on the other hand, I don't want to be the guy that's yelling and screaming. Like, I don't want to be that kind of dad. I want to be that dad that's like angry all the time about little stuff that doesn't matter. So it really is finding that balance. And it's hard.
I think the point is, and you show this also in the many corporate stories that Echelon Front, your company, deals with in the book, is that nobody ever wins by just yelling. And letting the ego take control. There's this huge why. Like, what am I micromanaging? Did I not delegate enough? Am I not being a follower where someone might have more expertise than me? There's all these different situations you outline, and clearly yelling is never the correct outcome.
I can get spun up pretty easily, and I can get pretty angry at times and emotional about stuff. And something I learned from Jocko is that losing your cool or getting angry or getting emotional is actually a sign of weakness. And you're letting other people get under your skin. You're letting the situation get control of you. You're not going to make good decisions when you get emotional. And it's something you got to work on. I think for each of us, it's hard for me to do that, but you actually have to look at it, particularly with kids. It's a great way to actually challenge yourself to think, okay, I'm getting angry about the situation. I'm getting spun up or frustrated, and I actually need to accept that as a challenge so I can practice getting control of my emotions. I can detach, and I'm not going to get upset, and I can see what the right decision is.
That's a great way to view it, is practice. So kids are often a great way to practice a lot of this dichotomy of leadership. But also, when you're going into like a corporate client, you're seeing it's like you're being embedded into a situation which is ongoing. The leader, the VP, the EVP, the CEO might already be beyond the ego point. Like, they're already micromanaging. Like in the case with the sales VP, where everybody was like scripted so much. But then one of the employees brought up the point when's the last time, to the other salespeople, when's the last time you ever heard a potential customer laugh? Mm-hmm. And, you know, connection, you point out, for sales, connection is really important. And just being scripted, it sounds robotic. And that, you know, I think that person was trying to act as if, you know, they were following, if I remember correctly, they were following like, you know, patent level of discipline. And you at first were like, that's the way to do it. How do you zoom out from that situation to kind of see what happens? I know you interview a lot, you go on the floor, you interview a lot of the people, you see what's going from the top down and the bottom up. And then how do you piece together the puzzle since the dichotomy has already been lost a little bit in the mess, how do you figure out what rule has been, which rule of leadership's been overused a little too much?
Yeah, well, one thing that's awesome about the job that we do is, number one, we're de facto detached from the situation when we come in.
Right.
So they're all embroiled in this, and they often just can't see it just because they're in it. They're in that storm, and they don't know what it looks like from the satellite view, that we can see when the storm's going to end and we can see how to get out of the storm. So that's a real benefit. The other benefit that we have is that the problems that we see in a corporation that has 150,000 people, employees at it, are the same problems that we see in some startup that's got 82 people in it. And those are the same problems that we see in a task unit of SEALs that has 40 people in it, is the same thing we see, the same problems we see in a SEAL platoon with 16 guys in it. And so as you start watching what's unfolding, the number one thing that I say to myself is, whatever the problem is, it's a leadership problem. Like that's number one. There's a problem. There's something going on. They're not closing deals in that particular case. The problem is a leadership problem. That's what the problem is. And once you start trying to unravel what the leadership problem is, that you know it's a leadership problem, and you try and figure out which one of these principles or which one of these dichotomies they've gone too far left or right. Because the first book has the principles that get violated just straight up. Hey, they aren't keeping things simple. Like that's going to be bad. And as soon as we see that, or no one can think anymore. So we've gone so disciplined on these people that they're not allowed to make any changes. So those principles are there, and you can just straight violate them. Or dichotomy of leadership. You can take one of these solid principles and you can take it to an extreme, to a point where we have salespeople on the phone that are literally not varying their script at all under any circumstances, and it becomes a problem.
And so you were able to, now that you're taking extreme ownership yourself of the problem, because that's what Echelon Front was hired to do. So your job then is to go to their leader and explain the why. Like, this is what's happening. This is why it's bad. Now their egos are kicking in because they're getting it from both sides. Their employees aren't working the way they want to. And Jocko and Leif are coming in and saying, you're a bad leader. So they're getting hit from both sides now, and they're going to defend, like, no, the scripts have worked for 17 years. I don't know why it's not working the 18th year. They're going to there's always a first line of defense, I'm sure.
Oh yeah, there definitely is. And something that Leif always brings up is that there's two measures of leadership. It's either effective or it's ineffective. So if it's been working for 17 years and it's not working now, that means it was effective before, but it's ineffective now. And we have to get over our ego, figure out what the real problem is, and solve it.
And so I would imagine in a business, there's one thing that's different than the battlefield, which is, so in the battlefield, you there's a lot of ways to measure success and failure. Did we take over this area? Did we capture insurgents? Did we lose lives? But in a business, the metrics are a little more simpler. It's not always about profits and revenues. It might be you don't want to have, you know, too much attrition of employees. You know, you don't want people to quit on you. But in general, it's profits. Like, profits are either going up or they're going down. So this is a solid metric to measure the success of a business. And so I imagine that makes it a little easier to kind of identify a leadership issue.
You might be surprised here on the battlefield. There's a lot of different numbers that you can measure by. And one of the biggest measures that we would see, we call it SIGACs at the time, or significant activities, which is enemy attacks. And that was the measure of success of our failure. And you would see units that would try to measure this. But so, you know, if there was 43 attacks today, but there was, there was 50 yesterday. So, that's a win for us. And of course, that doesn't mean that there might be 60 tomorrow. So, you know, that would go up and down. And so when we went into Ramadi with this seize, clear, hold, build strategy of going and taking the city back neighborhood by neighborhood, the enemy attacks, the SIGACs, actually went up. So that was one of those things.
Because you were engaging with them.
Because we're engaging with the enemy. So the leadership, the brigade commander, the colonel in charge of the 5,600 troops that were there, that and Jocko explained to our chain of command, we had to actually explain that this is necessary. So those enemy attacks are going to go up so that they can go down later. So there's a lot of nuances there, and people can twist those numbers to make it indicate something that they want to, that might necessarily be the case. And so you really have to look at that long term strategy intent trends over time, you know, rather than a day to day or week to week measurement.
Yeah, because right, not only were this enemy attacks going up, but so were our casualties, friendly casualties were going up. So it was even harder to explain up the chain of command, hey, this is what's going on. But now you look at like a company, and if you're the guy that's running manufacturing for me, and I'm just like, hey, you need to cut costs, cut costs, cut costs. So you're running manufacturing, so you start skipping some steps and using some worse materials that are a little bit cheaper, and now the product comes out the other end. That's great. You show me a quarter. We spent less money on manufacturing. Yippee, we all celebrate. Well, what did we do? We just put a bunch of bad product out there. We're going to get bad reviews. Our reputation's going to go down. And same thing, long-term, strategically, we actually lose even though we made more money up front. So we do have to constantly, there's a dichotomy. There's a dichotomy between looking between what's happening right now and what's happening strategically in the long run.
Right. So that's almost short-term thinking. That's kind of like Wall Street. Like, how'd you do this quarter versus the overall health of the business long-term? Exactly. And so that's always going to be something that companies wrestle with. But at the end of the day, it'll show up on profits, because profits will go straight down once there's a product recall or whatever. So what in your experience now with Echelon Front, you've dealt with hundreds of corporations and leaders and in every case, leaders having problems, I imagine. What's like the worst leader you've seen that just couldn't get it?
So people ask me, you know, when have you failed, and do you ever fail? And it's like, oh yeah. And I had a leader that I was in to try and help. He had done well with the company and taken the company from a pretty low level of revenue into really high profitability. And he was kind of a cowboy. He was a cowboy. So, and that aggressive attitude made things happen. But they got to a certain point where they didn't need to be cowboys anymore. They needed to be more prudent and take a longer look at the strategy. And the board of the company looked at him and said, you know, okay, it's time to stop being a cowboy and time to start being corporate. And he didn't like that. And his ego played a big part in it. And I explained to him in no uncertain terms, very directly. I mean, I tried indirect at first, because usually, you know, you try and work with people and you say, hey, I don't know if this is a good idea. I think you should tighten it up. And he, nope, nothing's going to happen to me. Eventually I said, look, if you don't start to behave the way they want you to behave, or at least lean in that direction, the board is going to fire you from this position. And he literally said to me, they can't fire me. And they fired him. So I was not able to get through to him despite all my efforts.
And what were the consequences of him being a cowboy at that point?
Well, he was cutting corners. He was running up bills that shouldn't be run up. And, you know, he was doing stuff. he wasn't preparing properly for the regulatory environment down the road, which is going to be problematic. You can get away with bypassing some regulations right now because the regulators aren't looking over your shoulder. But someday they're going to knock on your door. And if you're not prepared for that, then that's when you're going to fall on your face. And the board kind of understood that and wanted to tighten up in that area. And that was one of the areas where didn't really want to tighten it up.
On kind of the opposite spectrum there is what Jocko called battlefield aloofness. And we wrote about that in the dichotomy, one of the chapters, that humble, not passive.
Right.
There's an account in there about a leader we were working with in the SEAL teams. He was a task unit commander. And this is a very difficult training scenario. I was one of the senior leaders out there just monitoring my leaders and training and mentoring them. Jocko was running training, so we were there together watching this. And his platoon was pinned down inside of a building. There was, you know, these SEAL instructors that are acting as enemy fighters. They're the role players, we call them, are shooting paintball rounds, and there's machine gun fire going off and all this craziness. And so there's a bunch of casualties. There's simulated casualties. The guys are down. And the platoon's pinned down. They can't do anything. And we're looking around for the platoon, for the task unit commander. This is the senior boss, man. Like, hey, what's going on? And we can't find him anywhere. He's not in the house. He's not outside of the house. So we walk over to the line of Humvees that was out on the street some distance away and knock on the door. And he's just sitting in there looking at his map inside the Humvee. And we said, hey, what's going on with your guys? You know, he just comes up on the radio and goes, status update. And he was asking for a status update from his platoon commander. Meanwhile, you know, someone's coming up on the radio, you can hear screaming and shooting. I mean, it's almost like out of that movie Aliens, right? There's just total mayhem going on. Everyone's dying. And finally it was like, hey, why don't you get your ass out of the Humvee and go in there and see what's going on? And it was one of those things where I've actually seen that in the business world as well, where there have been leaders we've worked with where they're clearly their team is failing. Clearly there's some major issues that are happening. And it's like they're just above getting out of their office and actually solving those problems and saying, like, they'll send an email, it's like, hey, take care of this or fix this, and then think, oh, I handled the problem, now it's their fault, do it. And you can't do that. I mean, you actually have to, a leader, while you can't be passive, you know, and you have to be able to take a stand on things, you got to be humble enough to actually get out of your office, not so high in your position that you can dive into the details of things and get in there and solve problems and make things happen so that the team is not going to get overrun and killed on the battlefield, or that the, you know, crash and burn in the business world and, you know, take the whole company down with it.
I'm glad you explained that, because the humble versus passive was the concept of all the chapters I was having the hardest time understanding. But the idea of leaving the office, leaving the kind of tower and coming down and being on the floor with the people, which you often do when you're with Echelon Front, when you're trying to figure out what the problem is in a company, the humility of saying, okay, I need to actually see what's happening on the floor, that's what you're referring to with humility. Is you're not saying like, oh, I should be humble and let everybody else do their thing. You're saying I should not think I'm above anybody just because I have a title.
And you'd be surprised the number of leaders that struggle with that. I mean, that's one of the major things that we do with Echelon Front is provide that direct feedback line. And in some cases, you know, they're going to tell us things that they, in a way that they wouldn't necessarily tell the CEO or some of the senior leaders at a company. But oftentimes they don't ask. You know, it's amazing the number of leaders you'll sit down with. They'll give you their mission statement and talk about their five measures, you know, their five factors for success, and they have it all memorized. And you go out and talk to one of their frontline leaders, and they have no idea what that is. They can't. It means nothing to them. They can't recite it. They don't even understand what that's about. So that's where you start getting the frontline separated from you know, the headquarters element, and that's a very dangerous thing. So leaders have got to get out of their offices, get down there, and help solve problems.
And to hone in on the humble but not passive a little bit more, because I want to make sure that you really understand this. We want to be humble, which means everything you just said. Hey, sometimes you got to go down to the front lines. Nothing, you're not above anything else. You got to take suggestions from other people. You got to put your ego in check. If somebody does something that offends you, you got to think, is it just my ego in play? So all that stuff is about humility, but it doesn't mean you're passive. So if you're my boss, James, and you come down and you tell me to do something, or you give me a project that I know is going to grind my guys into the dirt, and it's going to grind me into the dirt, I can't just say, okay, I'm the humble worker, I'm the humble subordinate, and that's what we're going to go do. I'm going to say, hey, James, here's what's going on. Here's how long we've been working in here's the hours we've been putting in. Here's where my guys are at. We haven't seen the light of day in you know, a month and a half. We need a break. You need to give my guys a little bit of time off before we dive into this next project. That's what I'm talking about by not being passive. Or that's what we're talking about by not being passive. Sometimes you have to stand up. Sometimes you have to put your foot down and explain to your boss why something is wrong. Now, that's what you have to do.
So let's say I'm going to come up with a hypothetical on that exact one. Let's say I'm your boss, but five levels above me, a contract was signed. It's Friday. The deadline's Monday. We've got to deliver, 7,000 of these units. It means everyone's got to work all weekend as long as it takes, or else we lose this whole deal. Hey, Jocko, I'd like to take extreme ownership, but it's seven levels higher than me. My boss's 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 boss. We either all quit and walk home and find different jobs because the leader above us was stupid, or we just do this. That's
a real easy answer for me.
Mm-hmm.
James, thanks for explaining that to me. Now that I understand that we're contractually obligated to get this done, to satisfy this client, my team, we're going to make it happen. Because the team, it's not that I'm saying, hey, we're not going to do this because we don't believe in it. But if you give me no reason, if you just say, hey, get this done by Monday or get this done by Friday or whatever, you got to work this weekend. I want to know why we're doing it. So again, to be passive would say, okay, guys. And now I tell my frontline troops, hey, we're working for the weekend again. And they say, why? And I say, because. Do you say that to your kids, right?
Right.
When you say it to your kids, it doesn't really work. So if I said to my team, because that's what James said to do. Now they hate me, they hate you, they hate the whole chain of command. But if I say, hey, listen, guys, we made a contractual obligation. This is something that we need to get done. It's with this client. It's going to make us this much money as a company. And I talked to James, and when we get done with this project, he's giving us all next Friday off. So this is what we're going to make happen. It's
so,
like that.
So it's not just leadership. It's about using these dichotomies to improve teamwork as well, so that I become part of your team and we're working together. And then perhaps later, as a group, we go to seven levels higher and say, "Hey, that was a little inappropriate. We need to manage something differently from the top down, or whatever."
Yeah, I write a little point paper that explains the hours that the guys have worked, the production that they've done. You know what? Maybe I'm going to use this as fuel, and I'll tell the guys, hey, I'm going to use this as fuel that we can get two more hires. So that way, we're not working 80-hour weeks per man. We're going to get that cut down. We're making the money. We're seeing the money. So let's make our lives a little bit easier and make our product even better by having more people on the line working. So yeah, these are all things that you have to do as a team.
It requires a lot of trust as well, too. I mean, we often give the example where, you know, if Jocko is the ground force commander, he's the task unit commander out there on the ground. I'm the platoon commander, so I'm his subordinate leader on the battlefield. And he tells me to take that building over there. Then, you know, that's not the time for me to actually say, like, well, hold on a second. Explain to me why we're doing this, right? We're under fire. But if he tells me to do that, and I come back to him and say, negative, then what? So he has to actually trust me. What is that? If I say negative, what does that mean?
Well, you've both presumably have built up capital with each other.
Right.
So he builds up the leadership capital. Like if basically the last eight buildings he said for you to go into and seize, half your men died.
Exactly. But if I did it, if I've done that and I always carry out the orders and I do what he tells me to do, and this time I'm actually saying negative. Well, now he knows something that I know something he doesn't know. And he's got to trust me to know, maybe I see that there's some wires peeking out, you know, out from underneath the gate and there's an IED there, or I saw some bad guys moving on the rooftop and they're going to be waiting for us in ambush. So what happens a lot of times, some leaders will get, they get their ego bristles at that. So if Jocko is a bad leader, he's going to be like, no, you do it because I said so, thinking I should just carry out orders. But if he's a good leader, he's going to realize, okay, he's got to have trust in me to say, okay, there's a reason Leif is saying no. So
right,
then
so then it's the why. He has to ask why, and you have to, and together you figure out.
But in the middle of a gunfight, there's probably not time to actually ask why. So what he needs to do is actually take a step back and just give me some broad guidance, which is try to get some high ground so that we can put some suppressive fire on the enemy. And then what that now that gives me the ability to lead my team and say, okay, I didn't want to take that building for whatever reason. I have some reason for not doing it. Now I'm going to go find another building that I can take and I'll put my guys on the high ground. And then I get to accomplish the task that he was directing me to do. So that's the kind of, that's what humble, not passive really means on the battlefield. And it's really the same thing for leaders in any business scenario as well. So you got to have that trust and leaders have got to, you got to know it rather than getting that screaming match, people got to put their egos in check and recognize, give that broad guidance rather than if someone's pushing back so that you can get them to accomplish the mission.
Right. I think that broad guidance combined with both the leadership capital and the employee capital or, the follower capital, that's really important because just like in a battlefield, in a corporation, ground conditions sometimes change. So for instance, growth is a pleasant problem. So a company that has $1 million in revenues is actually significantly different than a company that has, let's say, $5 million in revenues and then $10 million in revenues and then $50 million in revenues. Like the demands on the company and on the leaders of that company change. Like you mentioned before, the guy who was the cowboy, he might have been good with the initial idea and building up to $3 million in revenues, but at $50 million in revenues, maybe that's he just can't handle the leadership tasks for whatever reason. You know, he had too much ego. Something psychologically was wrong. But you guys going in there, well, let me ask you this. How do you deal with it in your own company? Like you're growing. When did Echelon Front start?
We started December 2011 and became an LLC in February 2012.
So you've seen hundreds of clients since then. I'm presuming you've gone through some of these growth barriers and come out the other side, a changed company. What were some of the surprising things that you didn't think would change that did change?
I can tell you from my perspective, and it shouldn't be surprising because what we talk about in extreme ownership and now in dichotomy of leadership is there's what works and there's what doesn't work. Whenever we stray from the things that we teach other people and the things that we're talking about is when we struggle. And, initially, when Jocko and I were trying to, as co-founders, we're trying to make every decision here. As we grew, and got bigger to where we had more employees, we had folks that were doing different things. Simultaneously, it was clear we got to have a decentralized command structure set up where there's a clear chain of command set up. And so we had to do that. And so those things, we've had to put those things in place. And we have all the, we're on all different locations, across the United States. So, we have the same struggles that any company has, but if we revert away from those fundamental principles, we found out pretty quick that we're struggling and we got to go right back to what we teach, those four laws of combat, the extreme ownership, and trying to find the balance between these multiple opposing forces in the dichotomy of leadership.
Right. So when you decentralize, but you're also trying to take extreme ownership, that's a dichotomy. And a leader that you've delegated to, let's say in one of your offices, they might fail. And you could say, well, maybe I didn't train them well enough, or maybe I didn't read the numbers as much as I should have about what's going on there, or maybe I didn't, at what point, it seems like there's a gray area still where how many times do you have to touch that person so you still can say, hey, I did my job as an extreme owner?
Yeah, that's why we have the chapter in there, when to hire and when to fire. When to mentor and when to fire.
Mm-hmm.
Because you get to a point where you've done everything you can. You've mentored, you've trained, you've made it explicitly clear what the expectations are, and the person cannot meet them because they lack the capability of doing that. And at that point, they're hurting the team more than they're helping the team, and it's time for you to make that hard decision, which is, one of the hardest decisions that a leader has to make is to terminate someone.
Because the decision is really, there's a dichotomy there in the sense, do I terminate them, or is there something lacking in me that I didn't do?
Yes, that's where leaders struggle. That's why they feel guilty when it comes time to fire someone. You feel guilty because you think, what else could I have done? What more can I do? And so that's why it's a hard decision. But as a leader, this is where you got to have, you got to have some level of confidence and ego to say, you know what? I've done everything I can. I can't invest any more into this person. I'm taking away from my other 12 team members by investing in this one person that's failing over and over and over again to get up to speed. I'm taking away resources from the rest of my team to put resources into this one individual. Even though I want to be loyal to my people, the loyalty to the team has to trump the loyalty to one individual. And so it's time to let that person go.
Yeah, or I guess you could, upon investigation, maybe that person that you delegated to, he inherited a bad client, you know, so then that's taking up kind of bad resources and he's not able to communicate that to you.
Here's a good indication. When I'll get with a client and they'll say, you know, I got this guy over here, Fred. And, you know, Fred, he can't deliver his, he can't get his deliverables in on time. He's missed 3 months in a row and he's costing us a bunch of money. And I think I got to fire him. And I go, okay, have you told him that? And half the time, the answer is, well, not really. So how do you expect someone to change when you haven't even addressed the issue with them? So again, we got this whole thing. I call it the escalation of counseling. You know, if James is having some problems, then I don't just jump down your throat and lay out a 12-step program for you to get back. No, I say, hey, James, I noticed that you're missing your numbers this month or you're a little off. Hey, are you good? Do you need some help? Is there anything I can do to help you? Because, you know, we got to make our numbers. And maybe that's enough for you to say, oh, yeah, well, I just got one client that's a little trouble, but I'm going to get him on board and we'll be all right. Oh, okay, cool. Well, next month you start missing your numbers again. It's like, hey, James, you missed your numbers last month and now you're missing your numbers again. And this is affecting the whole team. So do you need any help from me? Because otherwise you got to get your numbers up to speed. Do you understand what I'm saying? And you're like, yeah, I got it. Of course, I'm sorry. And then maybe you do that extra work and you get to a position where you're making your numbers again. And then that's cool. Everything's solved. And we still have a good relationship, by the way. But what if you miss your numbers again? Well, now I might have to be more direct with you and say, James, this is the third month. Look, I didn't want to do this, but I'm actually going to have to write you up if you miss your numbers again next month. This is not good. You understand that our whole company relies on you making your numbers. Do you understand that? Do you understand the words that are coming out of my mouth right now? I don't want to write you up, but I'm going to actually have to write you up. And do you know what that's the precursor for? Getting written up is the precursor for getting fired. You need to get in the game. You need to get your numbers back up. What do you need from me to get you there? And maybe you, oh, Jocko, I didn't realize you were going to be, no, you don't need to write me up. I got, and maybe you straighten stuff out and that's great. Or maybe you don't. And if you don't straighten things out, what's going to happen the next time you miss your numbers? I'm going to be in there. And you know you're getting written up. I'm going to write you up. I'm going to explain exactly why I'm writing you up. I'm going to explain to you exactly what the expectations are. And I'm going to explain to you the consequences if you don't meet those expectations.
Why do you think people don't do that? I feel like people, you know, like there's that book.
Because it's a hard conversation.
Right, it's a hard conversation.
Because it's a hard, uncomfortable conversation. And this is what I tell clients. I say, listen, which conversation is harder? Conversation number one or conversation number six? Because conversation number six is a hard conversation to have, which is, I'm firing you because you didn't meet the numbers you were supposed to meet. If you have the hard conversations earlier, they're easier. So people get a little uncomfortable and they'd rather just not do it. And then the problem gets worse and worse. That's why I go to clients and say, or I go to leaders and say, have you told this individual that they aren't meeting the standards and what they need to do to improve? And 50% of the time they say, well, you know, I really haven't made it perfectly clear to them. Okay, let's start with that.
But like you say, it's 50% of the time they haven't had the conversation. That's how hard the conversation is.
I know
that someone
hard.
Who's been promoted to already be a leader can't even have, hey, you need to just get those numbers up and, you know, let's work together.
And by the way, if I care about you as an employee, the worst thing I can do to take care of you is not tell you what you're doing wrong, is not to have a hard conversation with you. Again, this isn't a license to be a jerk to somebody.
Right?
It's not. And in fact, the way you approach it can be in the most caring possible way, which is, hey, James, look, I love having you at this company. You're a hard worker. I know you got a lot of talent. I know you got a lot of potential. And I know you've performed well in the past. But where I'm at right now, I'm seeing you going in the wrong direction. And I don't like that. I care about you and I want you to do better.
And let's just play it out. Like, what if they become really defensive right then? Like, hey, what are you talking about? I've been busting my ass 60 hours a week.
Hey, I don't know what you're busting your ass on 60 hours a week, James, but I'm looking at your numbers. And maybe we need to take those 60 hours and focus them on the right activities so that you can get your numbers where they need to be. Because what I want you to do is I want you to win. That's the most important. Yeah, do I win when you win? I absolutely do. But this isn't about me. I got plenty of other people here that are hitting their numbers all day long. And the person that I'm talking about right now is you. I want you to win. So what can we do to focus these activities so that you're moving in the right direction? And you know what we just did just right there? We do that with clients. We role play with clients. We get them better at having these hard conversations so that they get used to it, so that they realize methods and tactics that they can use to turn a hard conversation into a positive conversation, because that's what good leaders do.
Well, it's interesting because, so I invest in a variety of companies and I have a business partner that I invest with, and 80% of our conversations is figuring out how to talk to the people we're invested in, you know, to either get information or to get activity or to whatever. It's all psychology of having these conversations, figuring out the other person's psychology, what their strengths and weaknesses are, and how we can address them in communication with them. And this is
leadership,
task.
And this is why we have that's why we have a business.
It's no different than the SEAL teams either. I mean, you may look at us and they go, these guys are not afraid to have hard conversations. I've had plenty of those conversations in back rooms behind closed doors with senior leaders, and you know, like, hey, this guy's really screwed up. He's not professional. He's really dropping the ball. He made a bad decision here. Let's call him in. You know, and you call that guy in, you shut the door, and you have a conversation, and it sounds something like, hey, you're doing a pretty good job overall. You know, there's a couple little things to work on here. So those are the kind of things that happen, and it's hard in the SEAL teams too. It's hard anywhere to have those conversations, and that's why when we help leaders do that and we do those role play exercises like Jocko was just talking about, it's game changer for them, because you do 1, 2, 3 iterations of that and you're going to knock that out of the park when you have a conversation with somebody. No matter how defensive they get, you're ready for that and you're going to be able to perform exponentially better.
So the same kind of principles apply in relationships, right? Like, imagine the last time you each had a fight with your wives. Okay, did you talk about it with each other beforehand? Like, here's what she's saying. Jocko, what should I say back? And then you role play it? Like, do you figure out how to talk to your significant others
that
way as well?
The disagreements I have with my wife usually go something like this. You know, I'm when I'm casting blame, making excuses, she usually says, hey, you wrote a book called Extreme Ownership. You should start taking some.
Yeah, but
so
that
usually goes right, just like that.
That's like a pivot, though, because that's changing the subject and throwing it on you that you have to pay attention to what you wrote, but it's pivoting away from the actual topic.
We do. We talk about these things all the time, and the more you can role play those things, the better they are. And my wife launched a business recently, and I'm trying to help her out. I'm trying to help her solve problems. And frankly, oftentimes I try to jump in there. You know, we talk about default aggressive mentality, like attack problems. And sometimes I realize, like, okay, I'm being a little too aggressive. I need to just listen, you know, kind of hear her out. She just, she just wants to vent about the situation and kind of let me hear her talk through that situation before I try to jump in to solve the problem. So, but absolutely, the more you can talk about it, the more you can role play, the better it's going to be.
Yeah. Cause I think for any type of crucial conversation, both these dichotomies and the role playing, communication is basically what you're saying is the way to bridge the dichotomies, the going from humble to passive, from leadership to follow, like basically being able to communicate the whys of why this needs to get done, the importance of it, whether it's saving lives or saving money or whatever, and then figuring out how to communicate it once you've diagnosed the problem seems critical. One thing I'm curious about with your company, you've dealt with so many situations. It seems like Echelon Front, no matter how big you grow, it's going to be a little bit personality driven. Like, you guys have written these excellent books, and at some point though, you're going to get, I don't know what your long-term strategic plans are, but at some point you might want to say, okay, maybe now we want to be part of a bigger company, or we want to sell this company, or we want to go public or take investment or whatever. People are going to say to you, hey, what happens when you two guys walk out the door? Where's the value in the business? So that's another problem that comes up when, as companies grow. And I'm curious if you've thought about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So what we did, first of all, the principles that we teach are principles. They're not personalities. They're not our personalities. They're principles that you can teach and you can learn. And we now have 6 other individuals on our team that teach the same stuff, teach it as well, if not better than we do. And that's one method of expansion, is we continue to bring instructors on, train them up, and unleash them into the world. On top of that, because you're still talking about scaling people, which can be very difficult, and we've created an online training system that's interactive, where you actually deal with these situations. You deal with a hostile client. You deal with an ambush situation. We put you in leadership positions where you have to make decisions inside this interactive training. And it hasn't rolled out yet, but it will be rolling out in the coming months. And that's another thing. So when we have a company that has 150,000 employees globally located, there's no physical way for us to train them all. Now, actually, we can train them all. We can train them all through this program where people go online, they learn the material, and then they actually apply the material inside scenarios.
And so, like right now, when a client, when you land a client, and the client says, "Okay, but I wanna only deal with Jocko. He's the guy who sold me on this. I read everything, and he's the guy I'm dealing with." How do you kind of phase them to?
We've hired exceptional leadership instructors, and these are guys we have served with, we know well, who have served in the Battle of Ramadi with us. They have tremendous combat experience, and this is they're excellent leadership instructors. And initially, when they ask for Jocko or they ask for me, and we're not available, or we're not, you know, we're above their price point, and they get one of our other instructors in there, very quickly they're asking only for that instructor, and they stop asking for us because it's about the principles that we teach, just to Jocko's point. And so we're building the brand of Echelon Front, not just Jocko and Leif.
Yeah, I think that's important. And again, I like what you said, that your company's about principles and also it's about communication, how leaders can communicate, but it's not about just the two of you. Although you guys have written these excellent books, and Jocko, then you also have this, you know, Discipline Equals Freedom field manual, which I love. And this is actually a great book for anybody to read. I just want to mention this book, Discipline Equals Freedom, field manual by Jocko Willink. I love this, that like right in the middle of the book, laughter wins, because it's related to what you say in the dichotomy of leadership in the chapter with the sales team. You know, you connect to people when they laugh with you. You know, it's kind of like a primal thing from a million years ago. Like, that's how chimpanzees signaled that things were safe when they thought they were under attack. They would all run up to the trees, and then once one of them realized it was safe, they would make a sound that sounded like laughter, and then just evolutionary, it just feels safe, it's healthy. So, you know, this book as a field manual sort of describes how you live your life personally that evolves into these principles of leadership and extreme ownership. So I just wanted to ask for both of you, what's your day like? What's the average day? You wake up at 4 a.m. and tweet your watch.
Yeah, that's what I do. I wake up early in the morning. I work out.
Because you have the gene. We talked about this. You have the gene. Yeah, you only need like 4 hours of sleep.
One of my oldest daughter also has the gene. I used to go to bed at 11:30 at night. Or I'd go to bed at 11 at night and she'd be awake studying, and then I'd wake up at 4:30 in the morning and she'd be awake studying. So she's got it for sure. My next daughter, she'll sleep an extended period of time if you let her. My wife will sleep an extended period of time if you let her. So it's partly genetic.
And I like that, if you let her.
Yeah. Well, and part of it is discipline. And uh-huh. it really is a root of discipline to wake up early, because even when you have that gene, and even when you're motivated and you've got great things that you want to do every day, when the alarm clock goes off, it, you know, 50% of the time you say to yourself, "Oh, wouldn't it be nice to just stay in this?" But shut up. You got to tell yourself to shut up. Don't negotiate. Get up out of bed and go do what you're supposed to do. And so for me, the first thing I do when I wake up is brush my teeth. And again, I've been trying to point out the importance of dental hygiene in terms of overall health. So get up, brush your teeth, floss, and then go work out. When you do some kind of physical activity is not just about being stronger or faster or having better cardiovascular system. It actually tunes up your brain for the day. There's physiological things that happen when you exercise that make your brain sharper, pumps more oxygen in there.
There's a lot of evidence that you can delay Alzheimer's by increasing, you know, by lifting weights, because it increases bone density and so on.
Exactly right. And if you put off, if you say, "Well, I'm going to work out every day, but I'm going to do it at the end of the day," well, then guess what happens? At the end of the day, your kid gets sick, your wife needs milk from the store, your boss calls and tells you that you need to do this project, and you end up not working out.
And there's also the phenomenon of willpower depletion.
Which I actually don't believe in.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Science is wrong on that one.
Tell me about that. So the idea is basically that by the end of the day, it's much harder for you to make a decision that could potentially be painful to you, even if you need it.
Right. Yeah, that's just junk. And I'll tell you why I know that. Because if you, tomorrow morning, you decided, you know what, I'm just going to sleep in. And then you finally get enough sleep, so you roll out of bed, and you say, you know, I really don't feel like working out today. So I'm just going to go ahead and not work out and just watch a little bit of TV. And then you roll into the store here. And when you get here, some folks had brought some donuts in and they got them downstairs. And you look at the donuts and they look pretty tasty. So you're like, oh, you know what? I'll have a couple donuts. So then you eat some donuts. And then you go upstairs to work, but you don't really feel like it. So you kind of surf some YouTube videos for a little while. You see where I'm going with this? Now, picture this. Instead of waking up and being lazy, you wake up early in the morning. Your alarm goes off. You get up. You do some exercise. You feel good. You get to the office here. When you get here, someone brought donuts in. You look at them. You know that they're going to make you weak. You walk right by them. In fact, you probably pick them up and throw them in the garbage can and look at whoever brought them in and said, don't bring that evil into my world. Don't do it.
Sugar.
You get upstairs. Lies. You got stuff to do. So what I'm saying is that idea, when you get on the path, it's easier to stay on the path. When you step off the path, it's a slippery slope and it's easier to go down.
So it's like a meta-discipline across all these disciplines.
It is indeed.
And if you have that, your argument is you won't have the willpower depletion.
You will not.
So you wake up, you work out. What's next?
It depends on what's happening in the world. I mean, it depends on what's happening in my personal world. If there's waves, good waves, I'll go surfing in the morning. Mm-hmm. If the tide is right, then I'll go surfing in the morning and get done with that. Then got a little time to say goodbye to my kids before they go to school. And then you know what I do. I either talk to a client, send an email to a client, I prepare for a podcast, or I write a book. That's what I do.
And what's your diet like?
Around 11 o'clock in the morning, I start grazing a little bit, usually on nuts, mixed nuts or whatever. I just eat some nuts because I'm not that hungry when I wake up in the morning. And then lunchtime, I'll have some kind of a smaller lunch. And then in the afternoon, once I get done working, I'll go to jiu-jitsu. I usually train jiu-jitsu an hour and a half to 2 hours a day. When I get done with that, I come home and I eat usually a very large dinner that includes steak and steak.
how many hours between dinner and sleep? You have to have time to digest.
Yeah, it's usually I usually get home around 7:30. I eat immediately and I go to bed around 11.
And so wait, what's the lunch usually made of again?
I'll have a Caesar salad with some chicken, or I'll have a couple pieces of steak or some chicken, or yeah, it's usually some kind of salad and steak, but not a huge salad and chicken or something like that.
And Leif, what's your diet usually like?
About the same. That's about the same. I can tell you, I can't even pretend that I'm as disciplined as Jocko is. I certainly strive for that. But I've got two young kids at home. Sometimes, you know, they'll get up super early. They cut out of the early workouts, or I want to let, you know, my wife work out or cover for her. But I can tell you when I don't do that, when I get away from it, you know, it's a problem. And so, I try to do that every time, every morning that I can. And we, even though we travel a lot, we have to work around that schedule. What I love about our team, you know, whether it's us, whether it's Jamie, our director of operations, or the ladies that we work with, I mean, our team gets together, we work out in the mornings, everybody cranks that out. And then, we work pretty hard. Sometimes that means that, we go without eating the entire day and then just splurge on a huge, you know, meal that night or things like that.
And Jocko, you mentioned in this book, Discipline Equals Freedom, the field manual, people like go from like, they wake up at 8, and at 1 o'clock they start yelling, I'm starving. When, you know, you've probably seen real people starving in Iraq or wherever you've been deployed. Well, and
yeah, a human being can survive for 30 days without food. You're not going to die. I haven't eaten today. Don't care. Bring it. What do you got?
Right.
It gets in your mind though, right? It gets in your mind that like, I have to have 3 squares a day. So, you know, I have
to get
something.
Which is basically just a marketing invention.
Yeah. It's not true. And you don't need that. And it's, you need to eat when you're hungry. And I think when you start realizing like I'm actually eating for fuel, it's a very different thing.
So I want to say again, this is a great book, The Dichotomy of Leadership, because I think extreme ownership, that I love books where the title alone changes your life, right? So I could think extreme ownership, and it applies to so many situations. Like let's say, you know, you invested some money with your stockbroker, you lose it. A lot of people will say, oh, you should sue your stockbroker. But the best way to live is to take extreme ownership and to, oh, I made a mistake. I have to take control of that. I'm just using that as an example, even though it's happened to me a billion times. And but then with this dichotomy of leadership, there's a lot of subtleties in, you have these rules of leadership. Like every executive that you spoke to, in an example that you use in the book, is a trained leader. They're already leaders. They've already been promoted to leadership positions in maybe a 100,000 employee company. And so there are subtleties and nuance when they have to realize their egos getting in the way. Was their confidence too high? Were they not a follower? Were they too foolhardy instead of just being brave? Was this a time when they needed to be a little bit more complex than just simple? So I think the dichotomy of leadership, and then what we just discussed with all the ways you communicate when you're in that gray area where you're in the middle of the dichotomy, I think that's really important. I think this is an extremely important follow-up to extreme ownership. So, you know, and like I said, I apologize again. Leif, last time Jocko was here, I said, oh, that's a horrible title. I said that
to Jocko.
I heard
about that, James. I heard about it.
Yeah. And
your reputation precedes you.
I'm following and not leading here. Like, it's a great title. The title fits perfectly.
When Jocko first used that word, and this was years ago, actually, you used that word. I think we were still teaching leadership.
Yeah, this is on the original brief that I'd give to the young junior officers. I'd talk about the dichotomy of leadership.
I had to go look the word up. I was like, I don't really know what that means.
Well, that's the thing I was thinking is that people would have to look the word up. But all right, let them look the word up.
we struggle with it's the best way to actually describe. It's the best way to describe these multiple forces that are pulling leaders in different directions. And we couldn't come up with a better word, even though we tried after your recommendation. But it just seemed to fit.
Well, I think also like I see in the stories you tell in the book, so many people use your extreme ownership book to say, "Hey, I'm taking extreme ownership," or "I'm disciplined," like, you know, like Patton or like you, Jocko, or you, Leif. And here you're able to say, no, look at this book. We talk all about this situation that you're having now. You need to kind of back off, or you need to stop micromanaging, or you need to let your employees, you know, be a little more decentralized. And I think, you know, that's why I say this is an excellent, almost two-part, they have to read both books to really get that leadership expertise. And I think the dichotomy of leadership describes it perfectly. So I apologize for throwing out a suggestion.
We won't hold it against you this time.
I'll always throw out suggestions, though, if I think.
We'll always have an open mind to listen to them.
Yeah, all right, good. Well, you're always welcome back on the podcast. Thank you so much for coming here, and hope to visit you guys in L.A. or San Diego. Where are you both based?
I'm in San Diego.
I'm in Austin, Texas.
Okay, well, both places I visit occasionally. And thanks once again. The Dichotomy of Leadership by Jocko Willink and Leif Babin. And everybody should get one. This is such an important book. So thanks again, you guys.
Thanks for having us, man.
Appreciate it.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.